Hello, all. Welcome to the God Said About Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an anarchist literary press that publishes socially engaged literature. The God Said About Us podcast is a content channel of Kai Draconis Books. And as a statement against commodification and a statement in favor of our anarchist values, all our content, including the books we publish, are free. So if you are interested in getting a free book, you know, one of which is one of my guests' books, then you should head over to kaidraconis.org. That's kaidraconis.org. So I'd really appreciate it if you went over there and just checked out what we were doing, support the cause of anarchism and making a more equal and just society and getting rid of all the capitalist scumbags who, basically make us wage slaves. So also I have a pretty interesting announcement. I've decided to branch out with the press, and we're going to start doing a monthly e-zine publishing. So far, we've only published book length works, but starting, I hope the first e-zine issue will come out in April, in which we'll have an assortment of short stories, personal essays, and poetry that will also be free to read. So if you are a writer and you would like to submit to the press, then I'm super happy to announce that the e-zine is going to happen and would love to see what you have written. So just head over to the URL that I gave earlier and you'll be able to see all the submission guidelines and whatnot if you want. So today I'm here with a couple of good friends, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg, both of whom have been on the show numerous times. But today it's kind of special. We're all together. We're all going to talk about Janet Frame's novel, The Carpathians. So guys, I'm going to admit that I found this one totally opaque. Mm-hmm. And it was just a head scratcher for me. I didn't really know what was going on most of the time. It all just seemed very routine. Like there's maybe this weird star that changes stuff in a way that I don't understand how it changes things. Mm-hmm. And but basically it's about a rich debutante who goes to New Zealand, and in this little town, people's memories may be becoming real, but then at the end, should I give away this, the last little.
Yeah, I mean, I would go ahead and do just spoiler warning. Anyone who hasn't read The Carpathians, I think it's pretty much impossible. It's pretty much impossible to talk about this book without bringing in things that happen at the end. So I don't think there's going to be a spoiler-free version of this podcast.
Okay, yeah. So spoiler alert, at the end, it's the narrative that we've been reading is a novel written by
her son,
the main character's son, but none of the events actually happened there.
But maybe they did.
It's
a novel anyway. Yeah.
Well, and that's a trick. This is a little bit of a digression already from the main meat of this novel, but it's worth noting that versions of that trick, Janet Frame has used versions of that trick in other books, right?
Yeah, Living in the Maniototo.
Yeah, her novel Living in the Maniototo, which Chris and I had read together for a class, there's one kind of extended sequence that at the end is actually revealed to be something that's been written by the main character, or sort of hallucinated by the main character. It's not totally clear. And so there's kind of a, you know, when we read it in class, there's a trick there where you have this moment of disappointment that, oh, it's all just a novel. And then you have to kind of take a step back and go, well, wait a minute. It was already all just a novel. Right? Like, why is that? When you have that extra, like, there shouldn't be any additional disappointment from finding out that the whole thing was made up, because your contract with the writer is already that you assume that all of that is made up. And so, you know, that it was interesting to see Frame use that device a couple different times in really different ways.
And I'll jump in, Patrick.
Please do. I really feel like I'm not going to have much to contribute. This is not stuff that I even understand.
Drink from your gigantic speckled mug and listen.
I will. I'd like to learn something.
No, I don't think that like any of this comes together in any coherent way.
Right.
And I think that the there is and I have a question about that, and I'll ask that now, and maybe you can think about it while I'm kind of like describing what I think is sort of like the setup for the novel, so that maybe the listeners who haven't read it will have a little bit of meat, a little bit of understanding for our conversation. But my question is, do all post-structuralist novels crave, like, have a kind of express a kind of a longing for structuralism? I mean, like, is it like a post-structural motif that, like, oh, back when things made sense? Because when I was reading this, which is a very post-structuralist novel, that longing came through very strongly, and I couldn't remember anything that was post-structuralist. I couldn't remember, I still can't. Like, is that something that comes through? But why are you thinking about that?
I don't mean to cut off your setup. I'm sorry. Did you have more to?
Yeah, I guess like what kind of feeds into that is that like the main character Matina is this very rich person who's kind of a life tourist. Mm-hmm. Like, she doesn't have an authentic like place in the world. And maybe none of us do, but she is especially, she seems especially like, she has heightened problems with that. Some people might not, but she does. And so she spends a lot of money buying islands, moving around the world and living in those places temporarily, kind of looking for some like authenticity in the world. Mm. And she's drawn to this small town in New Zealand. In her 50s, I'd say, she has a grown son, maybe 40, maybe late 40s. And I don't remember if it says, but she's drawn to this small town in New Zealand where there has recently been sort of this discovery of a mythology of the memory flower. And the memory flower is kind of like if you took the Cyclops who thieves fire and gives it to the people, and you turn Prometheus, I couldn't remember his name, and you turn Prometheus into a little girl, and you take fire and instead of fire you make it the memories of the people. It's a story basically of a little girl returning the memories of her people to her people. So it is a kind of about this return to authenticity, this return to like structure, the structure of the past. And simultaneously, like totally confusingly, Janet Frame introduces the concept of the gravity star, which is a star that, because of its bizarre gravity and spin, we can't tell how close or far it is. So it's a very bizarre thing. And in Janet Frame's mind, in this world, it destroys nearness and the distinction between nearness and farness.
Is there any real life corollary? that we know of.
There, well, can I just something that I'm I think might help address that, and that I think is worth kind of just introducing as an element early on. So one thing that this was a second read for me when I read it for the podcast, and one thing that struck me early on, she dies of cancer about 80% of the way through the novel, and on the first read that seemed to me like it came a little bit out of nowhere, right? But in actual fact, there are pretty early on there are moments where there's kind of brief it's briefly noted that she just kind of feels something wrong. She knows she's ill. She knows that she is basically on some subconscious level, she understands that she's sick. She probably understands that she's dying. So if there is a real life corollary, I don't think that corollary is precisely the word for it, but my reading of it going through on the second time was on some level, the memory flower represents life and order as created by language and kind of the novelistic perspective, or the novel as a form of the novel as a way of creating order and memory through language, right? And the gravity star is cancer and death and disorder. And the interplay between those two things, or the existence of those two things, is a way of kind of metaphorically externalizing the her kind of coming to terms with her own mortality. And I don't think that it doesn't line up neatly allegorically, but if there's anything that you might kind of consider to be I can't remember exactly what you were asking for, Patrick, but
I really was just wondering if I should have said this. It was a much simpler question than you made it out to be. I was wondering if there is actually a physical phenomenon that scientists call gravity stars, or if this is a creation on the part of Frame.
So I have a note in the beginning of my copy where she says, basically, I became absorbed, and this may be useful for deconstructing it further as well, but I think it might answer your question, Patrick. I became absorbed not in my power of choice, but in the urgency, this is about writing this novel. So writing this, my second novel, I became absorbed not in my power of choice, but in the urgency with which each character equated survival with maintaining point of view. Indeed, with being as a point of view. The coincidence of the rediscovery of the legend of the memory flower and the discovery of what I have called the gravity star tended to make both memory and point of view, which is removed and overturned by the gravity star, the characters in the scene now of celebration, now of battle. So she says she's calling this thing the memory flower, or the gravity star.
Do you think she means a black hole?
But that's
maybe a black hole.
I just noticed this isn't a note from Janet Frame. This is part of the novel. This is a note from JHB, John Henry
Breton.
Breton.
You're right.
So this is actually part of the novel, and we know from the very beginning that this is a novel written. That's crazy.
That confused me because I was like, this isn't Janet Frame's second novel. But I was like,
it was one of her last ones.
Yeah, it was her last novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy goat shit.
So I want to, because like, I feel like you said like novelistic, Hans, as far as like the memory flower being the novelistic representation of like the novelistic force. And I'd say like even more fundamentally, and I think this is what you're getting at, but I think the distinction is important. It's the force of narrative itself and storytelling. Yeah. And providing order. And there's a very interesting, I think, really beautiful thread that's sort of woven throughout this book that is sort of making the case that reality, like physicality, is two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
We have it backwards. Physicality is two-dimensional. It is stories and stories interlaced with stories and heritage that creates three-dimensionality, that creates realness and reinforces realness. And I got to thinking about it, and this is totally left field, but going back to my question before about this sort of longing for structure, longing for like for stories. Throughout the book, we have the Maori people who are rediscovering their heritage and their stories, and it's giving them power. It's giving them meaning. Mm-hmm. You have this really interesting take on New York City, where basically like Matina says that New York City is more real than other places because there are so many stories about it. It actually has this incredible depth and this incredible presence that makes it very different from Auckland, New Zealand, mm-hmm. which is a big city in Auckland, New Zealand. New York City has this rich, like, presence that is supported by a rich heritage of storytelling that mm-hmm. is centered on and built around New York City. Auckland, it doesn't, we don't have that sense. And when you go to New York City, your experience of New York City is guided by and shaped by the stories that you've heard about and read about and seen about New York City, to the extent that it has this, it's a different thing. Mm. In Auckland, if I were to go to Auckland, I'd be on, Yelp looking for where to get pizza or something like that. So like, it's different. And, this book feels like it's in this place where it's sort of looking at the past or looking at stories and looking at the dissolution of stories and the sort of the death of language, like the mm-hmm. overuse of language, the proliferation of cheapness of language, and postmodernism in general. And sort of seeing that dissolution as sort of like you mentioned, like Matina going from, seeking the memory flower and fearing the gravity star. Mm-hmm. Fearing the collapse of distinctions, the collapse of everything, and that becoming like that being death.
Yeah.
It seems like that's a societal thing too. Like we're shown society kind of veering toward this like loss of distinctions between things, this loss of like narrative structure that kind of gives order and meaning to the world. And maybe that's just like an old person thing, right? Maybe like old people are just like, the world is just meaningless now. But that kind of affected me. It felt, it felt actually kind of pertinent today to hear that, like politicians are, killing language and in that way, killing meaning. So I don't know. This felt to me like as much about Matina's like an individual's traversing this like distinction, this polarity between structure and lack of it, and as much as it is about like societies and peoples, like multiples groups.
Mm. Well, and it's telling, I think, that there is there's such a fixation on the idea of the imposter, right?
Yeah.
There's the imposter, Dinny Wheatstone, the imposter narrator who kind of comes in and there's some sense that she might be hijacking the voice of the novel. And all the people who live on the street in the town in New Zealand that the main character moves to, all the people who live there are from somewhere else. And so they're all nobody can claim any kind of, or none of the people that she talks to are comfortable claiming any kind of local authenticity there. And I wonder if that is connected to, if that phenomenon in the book is connected to that kind of anxiety that you're talking about, of the fear of the dissolution of story.
Well, I think she seeks authenticity there, but she's sort of disappointed with what she finds. Apart from from going to that party with, I believe they're Maori people, and kind of having that's, and then she finds that she can't describe it. You know, she's like, "Thank you, that was thrilling," and she's so like she feels kind of like embarrassed by the fact that words cannot convey authenticity, an authentic appreciation for an authentic experience. But she goes to this tiny town in New Zealand that has the memory flower, and it's all these old people who are not from there, who have retired there, and they just kind of like, you know, it's like a suburb in Florida. It might as well be. I had a question for you, Hans.
Okay.
About stylistically, like a couple times, like maybe you could tell me like how much this makes sense. I felt like I was reading DeLillo, because Janet, I know you mentioned a couple times to me, not necessarily like on this podcast, but like DeLillo will write like a descriptive sentence that doesn't make sense, but it sounds really good. He'll fold it into like this, you know, like larger sort of like, you know, structure that gives it enough of a scaffolding that the reader comes away with this idea of like what's going on. But he'll do that. He'll do that just sort of like offhand. And that happened a lot here. But there were also like just whole passages that felt to me like, man, this could be DeLillo.
Well, she is very... Sorry, go ahead.
Just the fixation with language and like the way that people talk about ideas. And they're just sort of free to do. Characters talk about ideas and the way that they're sort of free to do so.
Sure. Well, and yeah, and there's I do think that in everything that I've read by Janet Frame, she is a narrator in her characters. You know, there's this habit of asserting things that are sort of nonsensical or absurd or strange. And asserting them in this kind of very straightforward way, where if you're not reading really carefully, it can be kind of easy to miss how absurd they are, or how, you know, they kind of like the memory flower and the gravity star, both those are, and I've been trying to find a representative passage here while you were setting up the question, but I think one thing that makes the novel a little bit baffling is. There's a way that she has of defining what these things are and what their effects are, that it has like a kind of gut level emotional ring of truth and meaning to it. But if you kind of try to summarize it or paraphrase it or make it make sense, it's very, very difficult to do so.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, on some level, that's just a thing that Frame does, I think, in general. And I've never been sure, you know, as a reader, I know, you know, you want to dismiss authorial intent, but as a reader, I've always kind of wondered, is she having fun with this kind of play of nonsense? Or are these things that, are these statements that make sense to her, but that aren't going to make sense to most other people, you know? Is she fucking with my head deliberately, or is she crazy? I mean, how much is there really a distinction between those two, I suppose? But
I think she, yeah.
And like I said, I'm trying to find a good example here.
I have a passage that reminds me of DeLillo in content. I'm looking for a passage that reminds me. I marked it and I can't find it, where it's like, this doesn't make any sense. Oh, here we go. Here's one. It's too long, though.
But I'd mentioned that the definitions of the gravity star and the memory flower tend to do that. There's a part, it's page 57 in my edition. The imposter narrator, Denny Wheatstone, is talking about the gravity star. I, Denny Wheatstone, author of this imposter record, divine the activities of Corpi yeah. Street, the street of the gravity star among the ordinary, extraordinary people, while I study the primer of possible impossibility, the meaning of the meaningless, as if the gravity star irons all displayed meaning into nothingness, obliterates the significant signs and print of the alphabets of all language, leaves a smooth language of nothingness and also of possible impossibility for a new world to walk on, making new footprints or talk of making with new tongue prints. Which feels fantastic to read, right? But the idea that the thing that's doing all that stuff we just said is it's kind of implied that it is an actual, you know, interstellar object, and it's very difficult to imagine how a literal interstellar object could do all that stuff.
Yeah, I don't, and I feel like,
but it's asserted so confidently.
Yeah, it is asserted so confidently, and I feel like it is kind of like an externalization of like Jake, her Matina's husband, at the end. I think several times points out the, you know, the ways in which people using language are having that effect on language. And the gravity star feels like a coalescence and almost like an externalization or like a creation of a agent in mm-hmm. that process that isn't really like a real thing. Right. But you know, I mean, this book is just a mess as far as like what's real and not. So it doesn't,
well, it's a mess in terms of what's real and not in such a way that it very deliberately undermines the idea that you should really care about the difference.
Yeah.
While at the same time, it's interesting. It's a book that, kind of has this sort of steadfast refusal to make linear sense in a way that you can summarize in any kind of easy way. And at the same time, in this kind of nonlinear way, you know, it's trying to make on some level the idea that the loss of meaning and order in language is a form of death. So there's an odd kind of, I don't want to say a disjunct between theme and style there, but the way that theme and style interact are very counterintuitive to me. Unless I'm misreading, you know, does that make sense?
No, it makes total sense. I feel like that's why I asked that question in the beginning. Like, this feels like a novel that is sort of just totally meta, like meta, so recursively meta that you don't know what's real. And yet mm-hmm. It seems like the ideas and the themes espoused within it are like we are dying. Like this is death. Mm-hmm. Like the fact mm-hmm. that we cannot like cling to a coherent narrative. That's death. Like that's it. Like that's right, what death right. is. And,
the whole novel is on some level. I mean, it is the character who writes the novel is doing so in this kind of desperate attempt to find meaning and order in this sort of mess of kind of myth and conjecture and symbol coming from his dead mother.
An appropriation of myth. There is a kind of a thing in here that I think is, Patrick, for you, making an argument that capitalism is a force of postmodernity. This is an aside, but like the birthplace, one of the birthplaces of postmodernity is Vegas, right? That is, mm-hmm. As far as like a place goes. And it occurred to me reading this novel, I actually thought about Vegas briefly, that Vegas, though it's totally garish and like over the top and insane, and you have sphinxes on top of like Greek plinths, and you know, it's just this mess of different symbols that come together and mean nothing, but they're so like eye-catching and neon and in your face to get you to spend money. Despite all of that, Vegas is actually designed to be forgotten. That's like, that's the secret of Vegas. That's like what makes it function, is that even though it's in your face and totally like eye-catching and insane, it, like all kitsch, is designed to be like appropriated and used for a short period of time and then replaced like that and forgotten. It isn't, you know, the timeless design or the, you know, like it isn't the thing that is meant to last forever, because things that last forever, you know, they don't, I don't know, they run contrary to this place that we find ourselves. They run contrary to the theme of Vegas, which is to be something that is immediate and almost dreamlike and forgettable ultimately. Right. But like what she's craving here is a constancy, a narrative that connects her to the past. And that's something that postmodernity is and I'd say capitalism and
is in, sort of is in conscious opposition to.
Yeah, I think
either conscious or unconscious opposition to. I mean, the whole idea of postmodernity, if you see it as a positive force, is the liberation from the tyranny of those historically rooted narratives, that the yes. when everything is turned into surface play, nothing can really hurt you.
But maybe postmodernity is that impossibility on which a new narrative can be built, like that kind of, you know, that kind of that chaos. So like you need that destructive post-structuralist wave to wash everything away, and then you can build something new, a new language. I mean, like right here, this is 119 in my book, chapter 21. The consequences of the reality or truth of the gravity star. I like that, reality or truth of the gravity star. Mm-hmm. So like, what is the gravity star? Had to be accepted. The demolishing of logical thought, its replacement by new concepts starting at the root of thought, would cause the natural destruction of known language. A new language, a new people, a new world, and perhaps the end of a known civilization, as human cognition no longer supporting and supported by the words of the former languages, and for a time refusing to accept the apparently logical, senseless, near as far, heavy as light, fights for the survival of both habitual processes of thought and their attendant languages. The threatening war was not Star Wars or Atomic War, but war in a world suddenly deprived of its standards of sanity, molded within its written and spoken languages. Mm-hmm. And Matina wonders about the nature of government plans. Governments, she thinks, are hopeless at planning simply because to address this issue that she sees. Governments, she thinks, are hopeless at planning simply because they are governments. Maybe already behind closed doors, committees are awash with computer-printed papers being dealt this way and that by card sharpers at the big game that each hoped to win simply because each was human with an indestructible fund of vanity, greed, hope, despair, all the virtues and vices of general and personal nature. There is little to be done, she thought. Helplessness would encompass the peoples of the world as if a great fire were to spread throughout language, and languages. Language reinforces memory, rebuilds its weakened foundations, leaving the earth littered with the ashes of words, letters, phrases, loved and unloved in all languages. And because the human mind would have reached a new stage in its thinking, no fertilizing thought would fall in the ashes to resurrect each word and phrase and letter into a new blossom in the new season. So it's like this thing where she, you know, like, that kind of touched me. I was like, that felt like now. Like, I felt like shit. You know, that feels pretty pertinent to me. Yeah. But, you know, this was written in 1989 and we made it this far. So, you know, what's she complaining about? We're fine. Language is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose it's inevitably, I don't know, it's a little bit, I think one of you used this phrase earlier, it's a little bit of an old person argument, you know? And it's easy to be kind of, it's easy to be moved on a gut level by the ideas that are being put forward here, even if the more that you try to convert them into literal theses, the harder it is to either understand them or get behind them.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick, any? I know you said you were going to be pretty quiet. Any thoughts on all this, or do you feel like this has given you any sense at all of what the novel's trying to do?
I would say that I definitely think that you two have gone into more detail, but I essentially, like, on a gut level, I feel like what you guys are saying rings true with what I was thinking about the novel. My main question is, and I think this is especially important because, you know, Chris, you said that this reminds you of DeLillo a lot. And Hans, in our discussion on DeLillo, you said, you know, everybody accuses him of being a postmodernist, but he's not. He's an anti-postmodernist.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is, you know, the first thing you said, Chris, was, you know, this is a post-structural novel. Is this post-structuralist in that it actually believes that, you know, language has no solid foundations, our narratives are dying and we're all dying, and all that stuff that I personally find unconvincing about post-structuralism. So is that what this novel's doing? Is it espousing a post-structural position, or is it doing what Hans says Don DeLillo is doing, and that is critiquing a post-structuralist position? That's my question.
I think it's critiquing it, but I think that Janet Frame can't help herself, and she wasn't in an insane asylum for a little while, and I've written some of her other work. This is, you know, like she has this sort of like obsession with like the storyteller and story and the fourth wall. And she jumps around a lot, and she doesn't, you know, she doesn't, for someone who in this novel is critiquing, I think, post-structuralism.
That reminds me a lot of David Foster Wallace, who, you know, argued against using irony, but could not himself
help it
from using, you know, he was addicted to it.
Well,
so,
and my understanding of Wallace's argument wasn't necessarily that all irony is bad, right? What his position, it's been a couple of years since I read that essay, but as I recall, Wallace's position was that irony is fantastic as a leveling tool. Irony is a great fire. Irony lets you burn down and smash. But irony, you can't use irony then after you've cleared the field to kind of build back up, right? And Wallace is certainly a great ironist, but he's also someone who... he's certainly a great ironist, but most of his major works, Infinite Jest, of course, in particular, are, you know, Infinite Jest is very rooted in admiration, for instance, for kind of the earnestness of these recovering addicts, right? You know, he was in AA he went to AA meetings, and the novel is very, there's a great deal of irony to try to tear down contemporary American entertainment culture, but then the admiration that he has for kind of the earnestness and the attempts at the earnestness that these recovering addicts have in their attempts to kind of rebuild their own lives, you have to have something more than irony. And I mean, I think that, you know, the point you were making, Chris, about Wallace was kind of getting back to what we were talking about with the potential cross purposes between between theme and structure, theme and style, right? Where I do think that the certainly you could read the novel as opposing the postmodernist, post-structuralist loss of language and order and history, right? You could read it as opposing that. And it is also written in a way that, well, the question is
does the acknowledge that it does, that we have lost history or narrative?
Right, right. But I do think it's important too that, well, two things I would say. The first is that I had mentioned early on that on some level, the Gravity Star, like there's sort of a metaphorical, like kind of a three-level metaphorical intertwining where the Gravity Star, I think, on some level represents, like you guys have been saying, the post-structuralist loss of order and language. But then it also represents, on some kind of gut level, I think, Matina's understanding of her own impending death, right? So you have literal death and the death of the loss of language kind of tied together in the concept of the Gravity Star. The other thing I would say, though, is that the whole novel is framed as the character's son conjecturing. And, you know, that is, in some way, that is a post-structuralist trick, but it's also this kind of very poignant story of one of the characters trying to use language and narrative to build a concrete history for himself, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So it is interesting how the theme and the content interplay in that regard. But I don't necessarily think that not that you were making this accusation precisely, but I don't necessarily think that the way that the post-structuralist aspects of the writing of the novel are used actually end up kind of reinforcing the yearning for order and narrative that are underpinned. Does that make sense?
That makes sense to me, but what I want to follow up and maybe like point the question a little bit more. So you just spoke of yearning, like it's the yearning for order. And what I'd like to know is, do you think that, you know, a lot of what we see, what we would call quote unquote post-structuralist works doing is critiquing post-structuralism, but ultimately accepting its understanding of language. Mm. Does that make sense?
Can you give me a couple examples?
Well, I guess I want to know if this novel accepts the post-structural understanding of language. So let me think of some examples.
Go ahead.
So I'll point out Derrida, who is like, you kind of think of the quintessential post-structuralist in that he formulated some of these ideas around how language is insubstantial and it doesn't like connect us to reality, and his concept of difference, which just means that, you know, words, you know, language is a closed system that never refers to reality. And so he absolutely kind of believes in this post-structural idea of language. But then when you get to some of his other writings, he wants to talk about how we can resist capitalism and hierarchy and dominance. And that's something that I think is wonderful about his work, but ultimately isn't, you know, how are we to resist hierarchy and capitalism and dominance if we don't have a language that can give us the ability to do so, basically? So that's my example of someone who accepts the post-structural ideas of what language is, but then, you know, tries to work out of it. And, you know, ultimately, I would say he fails because he has to accept this post-structural idea of language.
Sure.
And I guess I'm wondering, is that the same for the Carpathians? Or do we see something in the Carpathians where she's like, you know, there are all these ideas about post-structural ideas about language, but in reality, language isn't baseless or orderless or whatnot.
I have a thought about this. It feels kind of like language is being presented here like it is not infinite in terms of like how much it can be like reshaped or poked holes into. Like at some point the threads will wear thin enough that they won't hold anything anymore. Like language is a fabric. Yeah, like language is a fabric, and you can sew new patterns, and you can poke different things, you can repair it, you can change it, you can make different holes in it, and you can like, no, I want this hole over here. But at some point, like the matting, right, in a carpet will just give out. Like it won't hold it anymore. And but at some point,
that doesn't seem to get us any closer to order.
No, but right? Then it's replaced, and then everyone dies, and you're replaced. Like, and that's it, you know, like, the from nothingness, structure is again remade. I think like what you're getting at is like, there's two types of people. No, but you can write in a couple different ways with post-structuralism. You can, stop at the deconstruction itself and say like, nothing means anything. Period, you know, and you could stretch that out, you know, Derrida like could stretch that out, but then you can know that and have characters aware of that and still like work within structures, you know, and still live within structures and speak within structures, you know. So like, I think that like any post-structuralist novel has to just be aware, any novel that even like acknowledges post-structuralism acknowledges it and then disregards it, because like otherwise the flavor of meaninglessness is too strong, you know. It's like it'll just overpower everything else.
But it acknowledges it and then you say it disregards it, but it's like, yeah, this is reality, so this is true. Like language is, you know, this thing that can't really get us anywhere, and then but they continue building anyway.
I think that this book is arguing that like there's a kind of a right now, isn't there kind of a sort of an ignorance argument? Like, aren't we better off when we just don't know that nothing means anything? You know, when we just believe the simple truths. And
that suggests that the post-structural ideas about language are actually true. And that's
they're true.
That's what I'm getting at. Sure. But they're not true. Like there are plenty of other ideas out there about how language functions that argue against these post-structural conceptions.
Yeah, and I think that, so I guess getting back to this book, I feel like
my bad.
Frame is saying that like what gives the kind of like the defense is actually like more structure created by like a bunch of stories that coalesce around a thing. So like a people's mythology, the stories about New York and in New York actually create an anchor. Like it's almost like how root systems anchor like the soil so that the rain doesn't wash it away. You know, like the best way to, you know, fuck up your coastal like plot is to take out all the trees, and then like the next storm it'll just wash everything away. Like stories have a kind of a binding to reality, a structure, a narrative cohesion that resists that force of nothingness and post-structuralism that'll eat away and sort of unmake everything. And yeah, that's my thought. But
well, and I think that
right, yeah, sure, I see what you're saying.
And I think that certainly there is this particular novel. It has certainly an elegiac quality to it, right? Mm-hmm. It has an elegiac yeah. quality to it, but I do think at the same time also, it kind of portrays this. There's a struggle between the memory flower and the gravity star. There's a struggle between the forces that they represent. And that struggle is perpetual. And it might shift in one direction. The momentum of it might shift in one direction or another. But, you know, it's interesting that the relatively early in the novel, there's the character, there's the old woman, Madge, and she, at the beginning of her section, it says, you know, she's been murdered, and because she's dead, now she has no point of view. Yeah. And then there's a little bit of a sort of a vignette of Madge and her granddaughter who's learning Maori, right?
That was actually very beautiful. Like that was like a short story, by the way. That chapter was perfect.
Yeah, yeah. And that section, you know, that segment, at least, and some of you may disagree with this reading, that section seemed to me like kind of a the force of order and memory reasserting itself a little bit, right? Through the grounding in traditional cultures, or through the rediscovery of traditional cultures. So, I mean, I think that the novel is, I don't know that it's as pessimistic about the eventual outcome of that interplay between those two forces as you might initially think. Certainly it acknowledges that this kind of post-structural crumbling of language, it acknowledges that it's a powerful force and it's stylistically rooted in it. But I don't know that I don't think it thinks that it's going to inevitably win, if that makes sense.
The memory flower, you don't think will inevitably win?
Well, no, I don't the think gravity star.
Yeah, yeah. Gravity I don't star. Think that the memory flower or the gravity star wins, right? There's a kind of push and pull between those forces. And I suppose at least the people on Corfi Street, you know, when there's the midnight rain that kills them all, like that, I guess that's in some sense like that's the gravity star winning there. Probably because those are all kind of people with imposter narratives who are rootless, but it's not. I don't necessarily think that the position of the novel is that's it's inevitable that happens everywhere.
I don't know if it's inevitable, but I do think there are sections here where like the case is made that even the use of language breaks down language. Like it even if it's alive and well, even if the words are alive and well, the they can be worn down through use, through lazy use. And like there's a, you know, like this is not something we should expect to have forever. You know, so don't treat it so lightly. I don't know exactly, like, it doesn't really, I think, like, that doesn't cohere in the end in, like, a prophecy of our doom. It does feel like, you know, and maybe this is my internal bias. I wonder if we're doomed when it comes to language. So maybe I'm 85 years old. So that's where I find myself
that
nervous.
That actually serves as a good basis for my next, what the other thing I've been wondering while you guys talk, I've been wondering, you know, does the novel accept post-structural crumbling of language? And the other thing I've been wondering is, do you two accept the post-structural crumbling of language? Do you know, because, like, if this novel is important, if it's critiquing something that we should actually care about, then we, presumably, we need to know whether language is actually crumbling or not.
I'll find the section that I'm thinking of that I think makes the case Janet Frame doesn't think that we can keep up with the loss of language, but it's going to take me a second.
Yeah, I'm looking through here too. I guess to answer your question, Patrick. I truly don't know. I don't know if I agree with that or not. You know, I've been very aware lately of the kind of, I don't know if this will address the question precisely or not, you know, but I've been thinking sometimes lately about, there was a video that I found the other day online where somebody took the, like, someone has gotten a hold of the isolated vocal track for Angel of Death by Slayer.
Okay.
And, you know, people have been, various people online have been kind of mashing it up with other things. And I somehow happened on this video of, basically it's the Air Force Orchestra playing the Christmas Carol Sleigh Ride, and then the vocal track for Angel of Death on top of it, edited so it kind of matches up with, you know, the rhythm of the song.
Right.
And it's very funny, but at the same time, it's there's an effect where any kind of cultural object that is menacing or unsettling or threatening, before long will be kind of neutered into this, will be neutered into something that is not unsettling, is not threatening, you know.
Sure.
In 20 years ago, that was or 30 years ago, that was that song and the whole idea of Slayer was something that, like, truly moved people as a dangerous force. And now it's just one more piece of kitsch. And I mean, I know that this doesn't bear directly on language, but what it does kind of bear on is the way that, you know, with the internet in particular, you have this easy facility for mixing and matching kind of images and symbols in a way that neuters those symbols. And it's hard for me to think that is a, well, if is that good, is that bad? I don't know. It's hard for me not to miss, you know, when I was 16 and I listened to Slayer, I kind of felt this, like, genuine thrill of danger. And I don't feel that anymore. And I miss that a little bit. And I wonder also if that's not one of the manifestations of that isn't, you know, people seeking out more and more extreme ideas, and then you end up with the online alt-right. So, I mean, I do think that, like, and again, I know that I'm not, the example that I used just there seems kind of petty and silly, and it doesn't really bear directly on language precisely, but
I think it's pretty parallel.
But the kind of bigger idea of, like, you know, it's like Las Vegas, right? Like, Las Vegas reduces everything to a surface. And I think that when you reduce everything to a surface, it can, one of the side effects of that is that dangerous things can kind of be slipped in through the back door when you think that you're just playing with surfaces. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of online discourse, if you think about like 4chan, right? Like 4chan is people kind of throwing around all these kind of quasi-fascist ideas with the sort of defense that no, this is just irony, this is just play of surfaces. But at some level, those ideas, those symbols don't totally lose their, even when you think that they've lost their underlying meaning, it still kind of creeps in. I don't know if I explained that very well, but certainly I'm wary of it, I would say. By the same, I'm wary of it, but I'm kind of also wary of traditionalism and reactionism. So I'm certainly not, you know, when I try to think about if the opposite of that play of surfaces is to pick some kind of historically rooted ideological system and buy into it fully and take it seriously, I can't really do that either. So I don't know.
And I think that that's actually something that has come out of the postmodern or post-structural discussion that just doesn't make sense to me. I don't know why you can't be a revolutionary. Mm. Like, you know, why you can't think, for example, that, you know, binary gender. You know, mm-hmm. why do you have to agree with post-structural ideas about language to think that gender isn't binary?
I don't believe that personally. I mean, the idea you just posed,
I'm not saying that you believe it.
I don't know.
But I'm saying that you just kind of said, well, if the opposite of you know, post-structural ideas about language is that we have to stay rooted in historical ideology, do you see what I'm saying? You said that there's this opposite.
I think that there's a distinction to be made between, you know, like, the plasticity of language and post-structuralism. So you can accept the plasticity of language and of ideas. I don't know how far down, and then sort of like, and then at some point, you know, like, you have to make peace with an understanding of like the true fundamental formlessness of language and ideas. And I, you know, it might be hard to kind of parse, you know, like those, like where that branch like crosses that threshold, you know, like as far as like, you know, binary gender goes. Sounds like a dangerous topic to me, but
what's
like
dangerous? Binary gender is a ridiculous idea, right?
No, I mean like it's a dangerous topic, I think. I mean, no, I'd love to talk about it, but it's like this—it's not the subject of the podcast.
And it can go wherever it wants. Yeah, I'm talking about it right now.
It's your podcast, I guess. But it's like the reason—I mean, like, yes, binary gender is a ridiculous idea, but I think that there is where it becomes like hard is it's like a litmus test for whether things are meaningless or not, because you can accept that gender is not binary, but still find meaning in where you find yourself on that spectrum. So if you use that as if you use meaninglessness as a litmus test for people's identity, that's dangerous. Even when I understand the motivation is to establish a canvas on which people are not excluded, that's good. But then when you have already kind of like established at the outset that the whole idea of like where you find yourself on that spectrum doesn't mean anything, you kind of preclude or hamstring, I think, the narratives and stories that help people find meaning and find their place on that spectrum.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. something that I think that trans people in general really struggle with, and people on different parts of the spectrum, not just trans, non-identified, any asexuals. But they need stories. They need stories to help guide them, because
sure.
because everyone like a does. Lot of well yeah, but male, female, we have a whole fuck ton.
Right, and, right. And, yeah, yeah.
So absolutely. it's hard. It's hard to kind of use that as a test.
Like male, female, we have plenty of stories. Trans people don't have a lot of stories. Absolutely.
And they're starting to make them. But
And I think part of, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, maybe I'm misunderstanding this. I feel like part of the idea that you're trying to get across is inevitably there's a little bit of a paradox. If we're saying that male, female is a binary construct that is actually meaningless, if we're saying the binary construct of male, female is meaningless, or that binary gender is meaningless, but then we're attributing great cultural significance to a person moving from one set of signifiers within that binary construct to transitioning to the other set of signifiers within that binary construct, there's kind of a contradiction there, right? But you have to, it's like to acknowledge, to make the argument that gender is meaningless, you have to celebrate a person's transition from one set of, on some level, meaningless signifiers of gender to the opposite set of meaningless signifiers of gender, right? Oh, it's great that you're identifying as a woman now. You can do that because gender is, binary gender is meaningless, but also it's very important that we respect that you are, that the way that we think of you and address you is, it's very important that our thoughts of you and our address of you are all rooted in a construction of female gender. There's a tug of war there, right? Does that make sense? Is that kind of part of what you're trying to, and if that sounded retrograde, feel free to cut it out.
No, right? I think it's that. I think that we simultaneously acknowledge the need for narrative to guide people in their identity. And then, basically say that the narrative is meaningless. And what that does is it puts people in a kind of like a post-structuralist post-structuralist bind where it's like, it doesn't mean anything that I don't feel like a woman, even though I am identified as a woman, but that does mean something. And there are stories that are written and need to be written still to help guide people. So the problem is, I think the problem is that when the structures that exist don't acknowledge the or subjugate or like hate on certain actors or certain people who want to flourish within that structure, who would love to be able to flourish within that structure, and then our only escape from it is to say that, well, no, structures are dumb, but what they want is to belong to the structure. Like, that's what they want. They want to be accepted. They don't want, they want the shelter of the home. They don't want the home torn down. So like, that's where it's dangerous, especially when it comes to identity, and I think it's useful. It's a mechanism. You say like, okay, this is wrong, but it's wrong now. Maybe we can build it in a way where it's right again, that's the post-structuralist cycle, or the deconstructionist, not post-structural, but the deconstruction cycle. You just deconstruct and then rebuild. But it is like, I feel like you asked this question. What do I feel, Patrick?
Right. Yeah. What do you feel?
I have the book here, and just summing it up, there's a section where Jake has telegrammed back Bettina receives a telegram. Her husband's been trying to write his second novel for 30 years.
Right.
She gets a telegram that says, I've written my second novel, come home. She thinks it's from her husband, and she basically says, now with the second novel completed after so many years, Jake would be one of the saviors, he and the others, among the poets who had always accommodated near as far and far as near without throwing themselves into disarray. Understanding of post-structuralism without being lost in it.
Is cementing that representative of what you think, too?
I'll get there. All cementing right, near and far, light and dark, weightlessness and heavy, mixing the processes of thought with substance from the heart, as birds mix their straw with mud saliva to build structures, to build home. With the writers, the secretion is the devotion to language. So could such devotion, given over the years, gradually draw forth the new language to fit and be neighbor to the new ways of thinking, a more gradual revolution, a seasonal progression that would all be barely noticed? And basically she's saying, my husband finished his second novel. Maybe there's hope for us. But he hasn't written his second novel. It's the son who's written his second novel. They didn't even know he wrote a first. And this is the second novel. Right. And it's only filled with longing. So there is no fucking... There's no savior. That's the trap. This is the trap. She's like, oh, we're saved. My husband has renewed the language. And it's this. And it's written by her son. So, what do I think? I think...
We're doomed.
We're doomed. So, I've had this thought theory. And maybe I've talked to you guys about this before. I feel like, people, there's like narrow and more loose definitions of the singularity. Mm-hmm. Singularity being like AI and robots, but sort of more broadly, this point at which the exponentially increasing speed of technological progress and increase in complexity would reach a point where we are no longer in control. We're not aware. You can't keep up. I feel like, Kurzweil and a bunch of like Looney Tunes are like, oh, it's for 15 years from the singularity. I think the singularity already occurred. And that's actually the big secret. And the funny thing is, the irony is that it's coded into the language of the singularity itself. If technological progress and complexity increases in its rate of increasing in complexity, increases in that rate of increasing in complexity, we won't be able to see it. We would never recognize the singularity occurring because we're humans. We construct, we rationalize, we create narratives around ourselves to sort of like make sense of the world around us. So we would just sort of fragmentize and surface, create surfaces for understanding the world around us when in fact it has completely, like the rocket has taken off. We're no longer on the surface of the planet. But because our brains can't conceive of it, we construct, we torsion and break symbols and reapply them and sort of like paper the wall, the windows with them to sort of like see like, oh no, it's still there. You know, everything's good. And I feel like the effort it takes to root anything into a structure, you know, like that exists sort of beyond this bubble of complexity and post-structuralism is so difficult to establish and maintain that, yeah, I think we're doomed.
But we're certainly not doomed by the singularity. I mean, the climate change is going to get us here pretty soon.
Oh, yeah,
soon.
No, yes. Yeah, no, no. It'll be climate change that kills us, but the singularity is what is going to make our understanding of it, our understanding of everything fragmented.
Right. I see. I think that's actually super interesting what you said. It reminds me of a novel I read called Solaris by way of Wittgenstein, actually. So Wittgenstein posited this idea of forms of life, that language corresponds to forms of life. And the reason why language doesn't kind of crumble in the post-structuralist sense is because it's always anchored to forms of life. And by forms of life, he really was speaking pretty literally. Like, you know, so the American form of life involves all the customs and practices that we see here in the United States. The Mexican form of life involves all the customs and practices that we see in Mexico. And language is connected and functions with those forms of life, was Wittgenstein's argument. And I find that idea much more persuasive than, say, Derrida's difference. But it wasn't in Stanislaus Lem's Solaris. It was in his novel, His Master's Voice, which is another, like, first contact scenario. But in it, the main character is like, so in every human language, there are translations for the word death in mother, because every form of life is Wittgenstein's word, not limbs. Mm-hmm. But in every form of life, we have mothers and death. So there's always going to be a word for mother and death, regardless of your human culture. And that's why I would actually argue that, you know, provided we share some type of form of life, we will be able to communicate and language won't lose meaning or crumble. But it is possible, say, so the main character of His Master's Voice imagines a creature that doesn't die and doesn't, you know, isn't born in the way we are. We would have no way of communicating with them. We would have no way of understanding who they are. We would totally miss out on their culture. And the point that I'm getting at is that it does seem to me that there are singularities. There are these points where we just will not be able to comprehend it. But I would say it's not because of complexity, it's because of form of life. We're not going to be sharing a form of life with technology.
I'd say there are those singularities where things are not really establishable, where like right. up is down is up, near is far, and it just doesn't work. But I would also say that there are fixed points like death and mother that are right. sort of immune, right? They're so fixed and established. But I don't think that language has to crumble all the way. Like, that's not my point.
Right.
I don't think that, like, language crumbles all the way. I think that what falls through is as things get more complex, is our understanding of authenticity and truth. Like, I think that that's sure. what's sacrificed. So, like, you know, the example is, this is no longer to do with the novel.
Yeah, sorry. It's really bad.
But the example is like,
it's my fault.
It is your fault.
That's I wanted to talk about some other things.
Yeah,
so
yeah, you didn't like this. You didn't like this book at all, did you?
No, I did not enjoy it. I did not enjoy it in any way, shape, or form. But go on.
No, so like, just as a specific example, the new face mapping technology that allows right. you to just basically make anyone a video of anyone saying anything, that just sort of like appeared. Like, I know I saw people dickering around it like a few years ago, and now it's like really good. And it's like, well, a few years from now, like, what the hell is that going to look like? Like,
right.
And our ability to, like, language is not just our ability. Language is our ability not only to convey meaning, but to diagnose it, to diagnose right. lie, to diagnose, to, right, to authenticate yeah. it. And we have reached a point where, like, that video of that asshole kid and that drumming Native American man
yeah, yeah.
it just shatters the world because, like, people look at the same thing and they're like, and they see different things.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that absolutely is a problem. Like, yeah, we construct different narratives off of the same evidence.
Yeah. And I'd say that, like, oh, sorry. Go ahead, Hans.
I was just going to say, just to clarify here, it sounds like the two of you are diagnosing slightly different problems that are both, you're diagnosing slightly different problems of communication that are both potentially a consequence of the spread of technology, right? The problem with what you're concerned about, Chris, is technology eroding our ability to tell when we're being deliberately fooled. And because of, you know, like the things like the voice manipulation of videos, and Patrick, I don't know, I can't remember if it was you or Chris that brought the example up, but the video of the asshole kid and the Native American that's not an issue of
who lives just across the river from me, actually.
Oh,
that's interesting.
In Covington, Kentucky.
That's not an issue of deliberate manipulation of content. That's an issue of we've constructed this idea that video and photography are forms that
don't lie.
That they're forms of authentication, right? If you have if you have something that's uncertain, let's see if there was a surveillance camera. Oh, okay. Now we have a video and that authenticates reality. But in fact, there was an article I read in the Atlantic that kind of talked about how, in the case of I don't even want to call him the asshole kid because there's a kind of judgment that's implied there that, the implication of that judgment is part of the point that was being made about the nature of video, right?
Right.
But, you know, the people in that scenario, the kid and the old man, they had thoughts and feelings and perspectives and were experiencing those in the moment. And those are important to the story that they're telling them, that they were telling themselves about the experience that they were having. Mm-hmm. And then you have video, which presents itself as truth, but in fact is removing important context because it's giving you this kind of it's because it's presenting that encounter without having the context of the thoughts and feelings of the people who are having the encounter in the moment. It's actually even though it presents itself as this authenticating force, it's actually something that kind of removes meaning and narrative and allows people to kind of creates this ambiguous space where people can reinforce their own biases and narratives. The fact that leaving aside arguing about whether or not the kid is an asshole, the fact that we're calling him the asshole kid is us, you know, using that video to reinforce our own biases and narratives. In this case, we might be right, but
if he's upset about it, he can call me an asshole. I don't care.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, video is actually dangerous for that reason. The spread of video through things like cell phones, we think of it as something that, because there are certain situations, you know, like videotaping of murders by the police, because there are some limited number of scenarios where the increasing ubiquity of and access to video is a way of disclosing hidden truths. It's very easy for us to forget that it's also a way of creating deeper and stronger misunderstandings and misconceptions, right? So on the one hand, there's the deliberate use of technology as a means for bad actors to deliberately distort truth, as in the example that you mentioned, Chris.
Go ahead.
And then on the other hand, there's kind of the accidental, there's the way that the spread of video creates accidental untruth and misunderstanding. And just one other, just speaking to that, my understanding, Chris, of your, you know, you had talked earlier about what if we are experiencing the singularity. And my understanding of that is, of your point, part of my understanding of your point was that the reason you would consider us to be in the singularity is because we're creating technology that has impacts much more quickly than we have the ability to understand or control those impacts, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And impacts, so on some, yes. It's not that the technology, like most people's sense of the singularity is that it involves creating technology that has, that you're creating a sentient technology and it has some kind of deliberate will that it acts upon the world. But in fact, we're achieving the singularity by creating technology that has no consciousness of its own, but kind of creates these secondary effects that we don't understand or control. And so in some sense, the spread of video as a kind of force of accidentally destabilizing truth seems to me more to the, almost more to your, to speak more to your point, because it's this accidental knock-on effect, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, and both of those are my examples. I wasn't really going for necessarily like the deliberate disinformation is, I think, a response as much as anything to the lack of a coherent narrative. I think that the more fundamental, like as you say, the better example is the ability at this point to look at, to hear, to read something, and to have very different ideas of what it's saying, even though it's the same thing. And I'd say that kind of a, to your point, as far as like those systems not having intent, I think that we've reached a point where those systems are so large and complicated that we don't really, I mean, like I think we're confusing intent and consciousness with, confusing sentience with intent. You know, those systems do have intent. They are like, the economy, the military industrial complex, YouTube, these are systems that we have created to sort of coordinate human life that are complicated enough at this point that no one person really steers those ships. They just sort of steer us. And that's pretty close, I think. I think that like it's sort of actually confusing that we're thinking that this point that we, you know, people obsess about, the singularity, is going to produce like the robot nanny from Futurama, the Jetsons. You know, like that's not what is actually necessary. What's necessary is for a non-human agency or sets of agencies to have intent and have tools for exercising that intent, and suddenly, you know, we're in service to those systems more so than we are to ourselves. You know,
we can't communicate with those systems because of the form of life question, like the YouTube algorithm. You know, we hear about people. You start with some kind of relatively innocent, you know, like a speech by Mitch McConnell on YouTube, and the recommendation algorithm gradually leads you further and further down the rabbit hole until next thing you know, you're learning about QAnon, right? Which is almost a weird kind of, when people talk about the dangers of artificial intelligence, like the classic example is you get an artificial intelligence and you tell it, well, make paperclips, but you don't tell it, don't make everything a paperclip. And it turns the entire universe, it destroys the world in the process of trying to turn everything into a paperclip, right? The idea being that if you give a system a goal without adequate parameters to control how it executes that goal, it can have very unpleasant side effects that you don't necessarily anticipate. So you give the YouTube algorithm the direction, please make people watch more YouTube. And then the way that it independently decides it's going to do that is by turning everybody, by giving everybody the most intoxicatingly nasty version of YouTube.
Right. And that, you know, there's the real world example of the, what was it? The AI Twitter bot who, like, within a few hours was spouting racist hate. Have you heard of this?
I have. Yeah.
Hilarious.
Well, great discussion about the Carpathians, guys. I've really enjoyed thinking about this Janet Frame novel.
We or you two talked about it for like 45 minutes.
Patrick, what's up? Why didn't you like this book, man? I mean,
Well, the problem is, I think it's what I was kind of getting at when I was asking you guys those questions. The problem is, I think that it is trying to deal with a problem that I don't think is actually a problem. Is the issue? So,
sure.
Basically, you know, you've got all this stuff in the post-structural tradition. And even if it's critiquing post-structuralism, I feel like it believes that post-structuralism, its ideas about language are correct. But I feel very strongly, based on Wittgenstein and other thinkers who came out of him, who are called ordinary language philosophers. So an excellent writer who wrote Revolution of the Ordinary, her name is Toril Moy. She's a Norwegian writer. You know, they just point out that, so for example, like post-structuralists tend to think that language doesn't reference, or that there's a problem of reference. And language doesn't always reference. Certainly there are many words that we use that do not reference things. But in this context, in this scenario, if I refer to Hans as Hans and Chris as Chris, I'm using those words directly to reference you, and you both know it. And that's the point that I'm making there is that the meaning of a word, according to Wittgenstein and according to ordinary language philosophers, is that the meaning of the word is determined by its use in the language. So that involves me using it in a specific context. Okay, and that's how we kind of get away from all this fear about what, like, you know, according to Derrida, words come with all these traces and connotations that always undermine the meaning we're trying to get at. But in everyday life, when we speak, we eliminate all these traces by the way we use it, is my position. So, or I should say the position of ordinary language philosophers, which I agree with. So I don't actually think that the problems that Frame is addressing are real problems, is the problem. And like, I don't want to like when I read the book, I was like, man, she's a good writer. She has these really good sentences. And, you know, on a sentence level, I found her extremely engaging. On an idea level, I feel like she was playing with ideas that Wittgenstein disproved before post-structuralism ever even got started, to be honest. Anyway, that's my thought. Go on.
I think Smug Patrick is my favorite Patrick.
Yeah, I mean, I found it very enjoyable as an aesthetic object. I mean, I think because the thematic currents of it are so opaque, it wouldn't really occur to me to evaluate my enjoyment of it based on whether or not I agree with it as an argumentative piece.
Well, maybe I'm
but
just...
I mean, and that's I think that's more characteristic of your reading style than mine.
It probably is, but I'm also probably rationalizing somewhat after the fact. You know, like
on a gut level, you didn't like it, and this is the explanation you've constructed to...
Exactly. Like on a gut level, it's opaque, I didn't get it. And now I'm saying why I didn't like it. Which...
So I have to draw attention to how like our like self-examination about like how much and why we enjoyed or did not enjoy this book is sort of abstracting the value of the experience. Like we're just like I can't even remember if I like this book or not at this point.
Right, absolutely. We're definitely abstracting here.
Which
absolutely.
Is why we're fucked. Yeah. That's why we're fucked. What's next?
Next is Zeroville. And I think we talking about Zeroville in February. Is that cool?
Cool with me.
All right. Excellent.
I'll be able to do it. Whatever.
So listeners, so we're going to talk about Steve Steve Erickson's Zeroville in February, and I'm also going to talk about Ursula K. Le Guin's The Dispossessed with my buddy Jed. So
oh,
one
a beautiful novel.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to talking to Jed about it, specifically because it deals with anarchism, so it's like something totally relevant to the press and whatnot. In any case, listeners, I really appreciate you tuning in. Hans, Chris, I really appreciate you guys coming in. It's always wonderful to talk to you. It's been so great with both of you here. And I appreciate you letting me kind of just go off and digress because I didn't get the novel. And like, because I'm an idiot and I don't understand it. So I appreciate that.
I'm an idiot.
I appreciate that. So, Pat, peace out, everyone.
See you, everyone.
See everyone.